is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and I have the pleasure of having my first cousin, Dr. Ariane Davis-Simmons, internist and endocrinologist, as the co-host and guest today. It's a pleasure for have my cousin here. We're going to talk today about a very important topic. This country is overwhelmed with non-communicable diseases. The month of April is designated as Defeat Diabetes Month. We're going to talk to the expert in the house, Dr. Davis Simmons, in regards to diabetes and obesity. We have a very obese nation. As many as 50% of adults in this country are obese. And when we talk about overweight and obese, at least 70% are overweight or obese. In terms of diabetes, and for adults, 1 in 7 of us are diabetic and 1 in 3 are pre-diabetic. Why are we so unhealthy, Dr. Davis Simmons?
Yeah, so why are we so unhealthy? I mean, so we have, you know, reversible factors, and we have factors that we can't reverse. So the reversible factors is really our diet, right? So we're taking in highly saturated, fatty, carbohydrate or starch-based foods. We're not moving as much as we used to. So we have really lack of fitness. And that coupled with genetics, which we can't change, so increased risk of diabetes because of being a predominantly a black nation. So coupled together, that leads to increased risk of diabetes.
And of course, obesity goes
hand in hand with
diabetes.
The fitness and the diet, yeah.
Well, when we talk about diabetes and being preemptive and proactive, just gestational diabetes, a lot of people understand that. So that's essentially developing diabetes during pregnancy. Is there anything as a pregnant woman to avoid getting gestational diabetes? Is high carbohydrate or sugar intake during pregnancy predispose one to getting gestational diabetes?
Yeah, so gestational diabetes is an insulin resistance that occurs after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and that's really due to a hormone that the placenta is making. So gestational diabetes itself should go away once you have delivery of the placenta, should go away. However, it's important to remember if you've had gestational diabetes, you have an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes within 5 years. So if you are overweight or obese, that puts you at risk of having gestational diabetes, being a older mother, so over 35 puts you at risk. And also if you've had gestational diabetes in pregnancy, in previous pregnancies, you're at increased risk of having it in future pregnancies.
And does gestational diabetes actually affect the fetus? I mean,
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, elevated blood sugars in pregnancy definitely have effects on the fetus, and it can have detrimental effects. So gestational diabetes, like I said, usually happens after 20 weeks gestation of birth. But if you are having high sugars prior to that, you likely had pre-existing diabetes. And a lot of women don't know because they don't get screened. All right, so if you're having elevated blood sugars, especially in that first 12 weeks of gestation, of pregnancy, that can have effects on the baby, effects on organ formation of the baby, put the baby at risk of having heart issues, heart defects. So definitely. And then obviously as the sugar elevations go on throughout the pregnancy, you have risk of a very large baby, so large for gestational age. So it makes delivery more challenging. So you have risk of delivery trauma to the baby, like shoulder dystocia, failure to progress. So maybe you have to necessitate a C-section. And then baby will be at risk for blood sugar issue or blood sugar issues post-pregnancy.
And would that predispose a child with a mother with gestational diabetes to obesity during childhood?
Correct. Yeah, there are some studies that show that there is an increased risk. If you're a mother with diabetes or to an obese mother, you're at increased risk of having diabetes later on and obesity.
So in our society, where unfortunately 70% of women of all ages, particularly even children, unfortunately, are either obese or overweight, when you're an obese female and you become pregnant, does that predispose you to getting gestational diabetes?
Yes, okay. It definitely does. But obesity is an increased risk for you due to gestation.
So fundamentally, antenatal care is a paramount importance when you're pregnant, for you as a pregnant woman and obviously for your unborn child. Obviously, you also want to make sure that you watch what you eat. You need to make sure that you have some exercise. A lot of women who are pregnant, unfortunately, do not exercise. And then it goes to the problem that is very prevalent in the society, where I might get crucified for this, but many women, the start of them becoming obese is having a baby, and they never overcome that baby weight. The life becomes very busy. They're preoccupied with their child. Obviously, they're trying to be unselfish and worry about others before themselves, worry about their family, worry about their husband, worry about their children. By the time they finish all of that, and many of them are working as well, they're so exhausted they don't have time to take care of themselves in terms of having a healthy meal, in terms of getting some exercise, providing some kind of stress relief. Mm-hmm. So how can we combat that? Obviously, once you have a child, I would say the average Bahamian woman might gain 15, 20 pounds. You have 2-3 children, that's 40, 50 pounds. And that's, you never lose that.
Yeah. So there's some things that you said that in terms of, especially if it's a planned pregnancy, we talk about preconceptional health, right? So you should be fit, right? So good soil, good, you know, for fertility. So the point is you should start an exercise program. That should be part of your lifestyle. Keeping a leaner weight, making sure you're taking folic acid, just being active. So you should start off with a lean weight. But you're right. So once you have the baby, a lot of women have challenge losing the baby weight. But again, starting with an active level, you can continue that throughout pregnancy. Now, exactly, if you weren't exercising at all, maybe they may caution, especially if it's a higher risk pregnancy. But if you are really active preconceptionally, you can continue that throughout pregnancy. And that helps to mitigate or reduce how much weight you're going to gain in the pregnancy. Life can get hard, but it's never too late to get healthy. Making small lifestyle changes. When you're heavy, or sometimes when it feels like it's an uphill battle, it's, you know, you say, well, I can't really do it. I don't have the time. But small changes go such a long way. And healthy eating, fitness should be a family affair. So even if you have, you know, several children and things like that, make the activity a family affair. Go walk in the evenings. Or if you don't want to go out, it's too dark, you can do something in the front room. I mean, there's exercise is on YouTube that's free. I mean, you can do Zumba, it's free, it's no charge. So getting moving. So even losing a little bit of weight will have an impact on not just your blood sugar, but your overall risk of developing metabolic disease. So
if we want to change the disturbing trend in our society, obviously we want to start from young. So we want to look at even when the time a young baby is born, a lot of them are overfed. I think a lot of it is because of misinformation. The mother might not be particularly educated in terms of what calorie intake is healthy. A lot of them don't breastfeed. Obviously, we're going to advocate that for so many different reasons. But what we need to do is, from young, we need to instill healthy living, healthy lifestyle, healthy choices for a 2-year-old, for a 3-year-old, for a 5-year-old. As a family, they should be eating healthy.
Correct. Yeah.
As a family, they should be exercising. So it can't be just one person in the family trying to be healthy and everyone else is eating fast food all the time and living their life on the couch. So we need to motivate each other to try and live a healthy lifestyle. And for children, a lot of it is getting into sports. Mm-hmm. If you're into sports, if you're active early, you're not staying in the house all the time, you're going to enjoy life. It's a perfect stress reliever as well. But we always have to look at what are the causes of obesity. And there's so many numerous causes. It might not just be because of poor eating habits. It might be that you're genetically predisposed. It might be because you have a certain medical condition that you might not be aware of. What are some of the conditions that can lead to obesity?
Yeah, so you're right. So obesity is multifactorial. So classically, we just think of it as, you know, taking in more calories, not moving a lot, but there are lots of different other factors. So you have women going through menopause. So classically, that's 5 to 15 pounds weight. Some people gain a little bit more. So you have hormonal issues, you have thyroid dysfunction. So you can have hypothyroidism. So if you have low thyroid function, thyroid hormone is very much needed for metabolism. So you can have slowing of the metabolism. So that can lead to some weight gain. You have medications. There's lots of medications that we're on that can cause weight gain. It can be hormones, so maybe birth control. It can be antipsychotic medications. So for schizophrenia or antidepressants, some of them can cause weight gain. You have steroids. You have certain diabetic medications such as insulins or what we call sulfonylureas, like dimethicone, that can promote a little bit of weight gain, or glipizides. So it is multifactorial. So whenever you are seeing your provider and you have some concerns about weight, part of the assessment is going through your medications to see if there's anything that is adding to the weight gain or making it more difficult for you to lose weight.
And a lot of it is also economics. I mean, in our society, it's a lot more expensive to eat healthy, unfortunately.
Yes.
Organic foods are more expensive. Fast food is cheap.
Yeah.
How do we combat that?
Yeah, so it's yes and no, but fast food can be expensive if you're eating that 2 to 3 times a day. I mean, that's $20-25. So it's yes and no, but you can make healthier choices. So if we're thinking fresh foods, organic foods, things like that are more expensive, I mean, you can do backyard farming. You can grow some of your own vegetables in your own yard. Even if you can't afford the fresh veggies, you can opt for even the canned or the frozen, which are going to be priced at a different price point and maybe more affordable. So it's just, again, introducing these healthy habits. Also, portion control. I mean, in this country, we have portion distortion. Like, the portions of food that you get when you do, you know, takeout is astronomical. It's for 2 to 3 servings. So it's 2 to 3 meals you can get out of one portion. So it's also having that concept of what is a normal serving size for me.
Well, as a urologist, I'll see men with in the mid-40s, 50s, gaining 40, 50 pounds. We find out that their testosterone total and free testosterone are exceedingly low. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And obesity.
Yeah, so it is, you're exactly right. So we see that hand in hand. As men's waistlines go up, the testosterone tends to go down. And there's multiple reasons for that. The excess fat that goes along with obesity is actually an endocrine gland. It can make excess hormone. So if you have an excess amount of fat, it's converting that testosterone into estrogen, right? So
yeah,
they get more of the male boobs and these type of things. And also with the obesity, they're having a lot more sleep apnea. So the untreated sleep apnea is a well-known cause of low testosterone. And we do see when these gentlemen lose a significant amount of weight and they normalize their BMI, that the testosterone starts to go up on its own.
Well, I'll always talk about the vicious cycle. Obstructive sleep apnea is a pandemic in this country. So many men don't even know that they have the problem, obviously, because they're sleeping at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the spouses are well aware of it because they don't get a moment's sleep. So they're alarmed that all of a sudden you're snoring and your spouse stops breathing. They don't recognize their own body. They're putting on 50 pounds. They have mood changes. They're in male menopause. They're asleep. Mm-hmm. Is always disruptive, so they walk around like a zombie, fatigue. What about stress eating? There's anxiety, there's depression. A lot of people use it as a coping mechanism.
Exactly. So yeah, so there are stress eating and binge eating disorders, which is very actually common in our society. So you alluded to something a little bit earlier, is healthy lifestyle from a child. So a lot of our eating behaviors we have developed from childhood. Whereas, you know, we had a good day, so you get a treat, right? You get ice cream. We're going to get pizza today. So these feelings are really tied around food, where I remember memories of me doing this and it made me feel good when I ate this. So again, when you're having a bad day or stress or sad, people turn to food to help alleviate and make them feel better. So it's that kind of dopamine response. They're hoping that this will activate the pleasure centers and they feel good. And that's really using food in the wrong way, right? Food is not really supposed to make you happy. Essentially, when we break it down, it's really just energy, right? Your body needs energy to function, and that's really what food provides. So it's kind of untangling this. So a lot of the behaviors we've learned, or feeding behaviors, are learned behaviors from our family household. And these behaviors can be unlearned, where we will then, you know, we recommend that patients do mindful eating. So kind of assessing, am I truly really hungry? You know, have a glass of water, maybe have a small fruit. And if after waiting and listening to your feeding cues, you know, waiting for your body to give that response to say I'm full before going for something second.
Well, I'm very perplexed when persons will go through these fad diets. They'll have intermittent fasting. So they'll literally be walking around with a headache, feeling like they're barely can get through the day. And then they'll binge eat. And then they'll starve again, and then they might lose some weight, and then they're going to put on the weight and probably more. What do you think about these fad diets? What do you think about intermittent fasting?
Okay, so I'm going to answer that in two responses. So intermittent fasting done right is not a bad thing. It has been shown that intermittent fasting can lead to lowering of your fasting blood sugar, so your blood sugars first thing in the morning. So it can help in diabetes, especially in type 2 diabetes. It can have some mental clarity. So it does have a lot of good benefits. But what we find is that some people are not doing intermittent fasting right. So intermittent fasting itself is not a diet. It's really just timed eating, eating at a certain window. Right?
But you'll lose weight during that period.
Yeah,
but
if you have a calorie deficit. That's okay. What I'm getting to. So there's some people who are doing intermittent fasting and they're not doing it right. So they will have a feeding window of 8 hours, but they get so much calories within that 8 hours that they don't really lose any weight, or they lose very minimal weight, or they're getting in very poor quality foods during that 8 hours. Okay? So if you are going to do intermittent fasting, it should, during that feeding window, you should still be following a diet. So if you're going to couple that maybe with Mediterranean, that during this 8 hours, we're going to get a lot of fresh fruits, vegetables, lean meats, healthy fats, that's a better way to do it. The thing with the fad diet, so if we're talking about, you know, cabbage soup diet, these weird and wonderful things, you can lose a lot of weight in a short period of time, but it's not sustainable. So when we talk about lifestyle change, long-term weight loss, and weight maintenance, we're talking about picking a diet that you're able to adhere to for the long term. So it should have a calorie deficit, so overall healthy food that you're able to sustain for the long term to keep the weight off. With the fad diets, people yo-yo, they do it for 2 weeks, they lose mostly water weight, and then they regain everything back.
So I think, and we talk about type 1, we talk about type 2, there's even mention of a type 1.5. What is diabetes?
Okay, so diabetes just means there's excess sugar in the blood. And this happens if we're talking about type 2, which is the main type of diabetes in our population. And in general, 90% of patients coming in with diabetes are going to have type 2. This is usually due to three main things. There is the liver making too much sugar. There is increased insulin resistance because these individuals tend to be overweight or obese. So the insulin is not working as effectively. They usually have a poor diet. And then over time, the insulin production that they all make starts to decline. So there's a relative deficiency. They make insulin, but it's not working as effectively, right? So that's the main thing. With type 2 diabetes, it tends to be a strong family correlation. There's more obesity. Like you talked about, more if women who have gestational diabetes, polycystic ovarian syndrome. And type 2 diabetes with overweight and obese individuals tend to be really lifestyle mediated. And then you have type 1 diabetes, which is autoimmune. So this is when the body is producing something that is attacking the cells that make insulin. And this leads to insulin decline. These individuals will always need insulin for therapy. We classically used to think of it only happening in childhood or adolescence, but it really can happen at any age. So that's where the 1.5 comes from. So when we talk about type 1.5, this is really what we call late autoimmune diabetes in adults. It is a type 1 occurring at a later time. So there's a slower decline in the insulin production.
There's another term that a lot of persons, even physicians, aren't really well aware of, and that's metabolic syndrome. So as we get older, particularly I see it as a urologist in middle-aged men with low testosterone, they're at risk of metabolic syndrome, and that can be disastrous. If you're not a diabetic, you're predisposed to becoming a diabetic. If you do have diabetes, it's going to be more difficult for you to control that diabetes. Can you speak a little bit about metabolic syndrome?
Yes. Yeah, so metabolic syndrome encompasses abnormal blood sugars, right? Increased waist circumference, so increased fat. So if you're a man and you have a waist circumference over 40 inches, if you're a woman over 35 inches, or if you have obesity status, and then elevated lipids. So low HDL, which is the good cholesterol that helps to protect you, high triglycerides, high LDL. And why do we really care about all of this? The syndrome is because it's linked to cardiometabolic disease, cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes. It is a big problem. And the main driver for metabolic syndrome is really obesity, right? It is that excess fat increasing these cytokines, adipokines, so these chemical factors that is leading to all of this metabolic disease. And metabolic syndrome is increasing in worldwide, but in particularly the Western hemisphere, because our waistlines are expanding. We're becoming fatter.
I read maybe 6 months ago, the American Diabetic Association published new treatment guidelines. So they basically stated, which is well known, that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death for diabetics. But now they're recommending that you have an LDL cholesterol of 70 and that your blood pressure should be less than 130 over 80 if you want to improve and optimize your diabetic control. I mean, that's very difficult to achieve. But obviously, cardiovascular death is the leading cause of death in our society and throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And we have a predominance of diabetics or pre-diabetics, particularly those who are poorly controlled. Don't you think we can improve the longevity of our nation as a whole if we can prevent persons from becoming diabetic and those who are diabetic? We even talk about reversing type 2 diabetes. Let's talk about that. Can you reverse type 2 diabetes?
Yes, you definitely can. So classically, again, when we talk about type 2 diabetics, majority of them are going to be overweight or obese, right? So if this is what we concept of what we call diabesity, right? So this is the obesity driving the diabetes. So if you make significant lifestyle changes, meaning get more active lifestyle, if you're overweight or obese, reducing your weight, and if you're doing all of this within the early phases of when you develop diabetes, within that first 7 years, we do see reversibility. Classically, I want to give an example, is that when we talk about bariatric surgery, so obese type 2s who undergo bariatric surgery, where they're losing about up to 30% of their excess body weight, we see reversibility. It goes away. You take them off all meds. This is classic. So if you are an obese type 2, just by losing 7.5% of your excess body weight, you can have improvement in your blood sugars. But by losing up to 20% of your excess body weight, diabetes can go away.
Well, you talk about having gastric bypass. I know you're part of a program at a doctor's mm-hmm. hospital, and it's a holistic approach. You want to make sure that psychologically, emotionally, you're prepared. You want to make sure you optimize yourself with all medical conditions. Who is an ideal candidate for gastric bypass?
Okay, so when we talk about what is the NIH criteria for bypass, it will be someone who has a BMI, so a body mass index, of 35 or more with a weight-related complication. So that can be diabetes, that can be fatty liver, that can be sleep apnea, that can be PCOS. And if you don't have diabetes but you have a BMI of over 40, you're a candidate. So those are kind of the ideal people. And if you're in the extremes of BMI, where you're 60, 70, they may even consider, a more extensive bariatric surgery like a gastric bypass.
Okay. Well, what would you recommend for someone who is fighting with obesity, newly diagnosed diabetic, and they feel hopelessness? They become depressed. But obviously, diabetes affects every aspect of your life. A lot of people feel like their life is over before it starts. They might be 22. They're just starting their career. They're looking to get married, to get pregnant. Diabetes can be a major blow because it can affect every bodily system. It can affect you getting pregnant. It can affect you sexually, females and males. Mm-hmm. It basically overwhelms your life because you have to know at all the times, what are you eating? Make sure that you're getting a normal amount of exercise. You have to be very, very pedantic in everything that you do. A lot of people do have depression with diabetes.
Oh, yeah.
How do you address that as an endocrinologist?
So you're definitely right. So diabetes can be tough, in particularly if you're on like multi-dose insulin injections, right? So it's a lot. You have to always check your sugars 4 to 5 times a day, worry about food, things like that. And diabetes burnout, this is the concept we were talking about, depression, where people just get overwhelmed and they stop everything, where they may stop their meds, they stop monitoring. So it's very real. The rates of anxiety in diabetic persons are much more elevated than in the general population. So 30% of diabetics will have episodes of anxiety or depression. So it is real. And there may be not just an emotional component of it, but there's likely a physiological reason, because we know that there are insulin receptors on the brain. So it is a target organ for insulin. And this is probably why they have this increased development of depression and anxiety. So what I would say is, if you are someone with type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes that is poorly controlled and feeling overwhelmed, the mental health has to be addressed. And I have lots of patients who go through that, or a percentage of patients who go through that. And I have to it's a multidisciplinary approach. I get psychiatry or psychology involved to assess, because unless that depression or anxiety is treated, I can't really properly manage the diabetes, okay? So that's very important. But in terms of if you're newly diagnosed and you just feel like, okay, my life is over, that's not really true. So when we talk about diabetes complications, all the fearful ones, blindness, dialysis, amputations, we're really talking about poorly controlled diabetes that's occurring over the long term. So all of the complications of diabetes are preventable, all of them.
And a lot of people have poor coping mechanisms. They actually will live in denial. So they don't accept it.
Correct.
I won't take that on.
Or they said, I'm prayed it away, I don't claim it.
Well, I'll always advocate praying, but you need to have a physician along with God in your life. We'll be right back at the end of the break.
Always on the go? Missed a show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Hold on, sweetie. Mommy's sending a text.
But Mommy, my teacher said that you're not supposed to text and drive.
I know what I'm doing.
Oh, look, Mommy, the Smith twins. Mommy, watch out!
In 2017, approximately 54 people died as a result of traffic accidents. A percentage of these fatalities occurred as a result of texting while driving. Just taking your eyes off the road for 5 seconds can increase your chance of crashing. Remember, even the smallest voice counts.
Texan.
Brought to you by UB Radio and Guardian Radio 96.9.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. I'm very, very proud, and I'm sure my grandparents up there in heaven are very proud that we have my first cousin, Dr. Ariane Davis Simmons, in the studio. She is, my grandparents, Hilda Davis and Ulysses Davis, had 11 children. My mother was the youngest of the 11, and her father was ninth. In the row. And she's doing great things as an endocrinologist and an internist. I couldn't be proud of her as I am of many of my cousins who are doing great things and contributing to our society. But here we're trying to combat a major problem, a major pandemic in this society, and it's a silent killer, and that's diabetes and obesity. And they go hand in hand, unfortunately, and along with cardiovascular disease, which is the number one killer in our society. So we were talking about the persons being diagnosed with diabetes of all ages, and many of them are in denial. Many of them don't really have proper coping mechanisms. I see patients all the time who will say, all right, I was diagnosed as a diabetic 10 years ago, but I don't really believe it. I might take my diabetic meds when I feel like I'm about to pass out, or my vision's becoming so blurry, or I have a horrible headache, or I have back pain, or they're waiting for irreversible damage to every single organ of their body, and it could be profound. I mean, we look at the overwhelming number of persons in our society who are on hemodialysis. It's costly to our society on so many levels, costly to the individual, emotionally, physically, financially, overwhelmingly expensive for our government and our healthcare system. And so many of these persons didn't have to go down that road of being on dialysis every other day and waking up 4 o'clock in the morning and having to go through the agony of trying to get arterial venous access and getting ports putting in and waiting on a renal transplant list, et cetera, et cetera. What do you tell persons who believe that, okay, I cut out sugar. I don't have as much sugar as I used to. I don't go to the fast food restaurant more than once a week. So I've cured my diabetes. So many people believe that they can cure their own diabetes. Yes, type 2 can be reversed. We're not going to deny that. But we need to do that hand in hand with a physician who's trained.
Correct. So the thing is, when patients say this, they said, oh, no, I know my numbers are okay. But they don't monitor. So this is what we're talking about. In terms of diabetes management, self-care is very important. That's 90% of the management. And that's including eating right? So reducing your starches, not eating a lot of sweets, balanced diet. We talk about plate method, getting moving, but you also need to be monitoring so you know what your numbers are, right? So there's certain health numbers that you should be aware of so that we can prevent these metabolic issues and metabolic complications. So if we're talking about, if you're on oral, so just on tablets for diabetes, you should be checking your sugar at least once a day. And you should vary the time. So
it's a know if your number. A lot of persons, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
They'll just do a fasting sugar, and they believe that
that's it.
And they're fine.
You're right. That's only a small percentage of the picture, right? So that would be your lowest sugar
and
for the day.
And they take that as what they sugar
gospel,
is for the whole day.
Yes. That's your lowest sugar for the day. So you should be doing also a two-hour check after meals. So, you know, if you're on oral, you can rotate. You can do fasting some days. You can do two-hour checks so you can see what your numbers where your numbers are. And if you are doing a two-hour post-meal check, so after meals, your blood sugar should be less than 180. So if you're able to achieve a normal, appropriate fasting, so for diabetics, we're talking about 80 to 130, and 2 hours after meal, less than 180. If you're able to achieve that and maintain in those levels, your A1C should be controlled. So monitoring is a big component of that. And when we also talk about monitoring, you're doing your A1C. So that's your three-month diabetes check. So it's how much sugar is bound to your hemoglobin. So you should be checking with your doctor for that is my A1C at target? What should I be? So for young individuals without any complications, we're shooting for an A1C of less than 6.5. For most of the general population, it's less than 7%. So knowing the targets, knowing what's my blood pressure, am I at target? That should be less than 130 over 80. If it's an older adult, maybe less than 140 over 90. You know, what is my kidney function doing? What is my cholesterol? And as you said, if you're very high risk of heart disease, heart attacks, and strokes, we're shooting for a LDL less than 70. If it's just kind of you have diabetes, no other risk factors, less than 100. But your numbers should be. So it's your health numbers.
So if somebody has insulin resistance, my understanding is that the body will make more insulin and for could be several years where someone doesn't become a pre-diabetic or even a diabetic. So we can catch this early. We can reverse if it's modification of your behavior or your diet or so many things that we can do to get you from becoming pre-diabetic. Or if you are pre-diabetic, let's not get you to become a diabetic.
Yeah.
If you have type 2 diabetes, we can reverse it, but you can't do it on your own. That's the most important thing. You don't want to have that end organ damage to your eyes, to your liver, to your heart, to your blood vessels. For men, I'm speaking to men, and obviously I always speak this testament all the time. The most important organ in any Bohemian man is what? And I don't even have to say. If you want that to function and function at the highest level of efficiency and reliability, let's make sure that you don't develop non-communicable diseases. And if you do, let's make sure they're well controlled, because hypertension, diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, cardiovascular disease are the number one risk factors for erectile dysfunction. So even from that aspect, let that be the motivation for, if you do have erectile dysfunction, seek help, because that might be the first instance where we can pick up that you're either diabetic or pre-diabetic, or that you have uncontrolled diabetes, or that you have sleep apnea, or you have low testosterone, or your cholesterol is out of control, or you have early stage of cardiovascular disease where we can prevent you from getting that heart attack or stroke 12 or 15 years down the road. A lot of Bohemians are scared of needles, even pricking themselves for checking their sugar, their glucose. There's a lot of advancements in terms of diabetic management. There's continuous glucose monitoring. I mean, there's a device you can connect it to your app. There's so many different companies. I think Libre is one of them. Speak a little bit more about that, because I think that'll give a lot of persons hope that, you know what, that allows you to really fine-tune your sugar control, because you just had a meal. You might even get an alert on your app to say, all right, that was too much sugar, that was too much carbohydrate. How does that work?
Yeah, so you're definitely right. So in terms of diabetes technology, diabetes research, there has been a lot that has evolved over the past 15 years. And as I said, diabetes, you're monitoring your blood sugars is an important part of self-care. So this is where the continuous glucose monitors come in. So these are small devices that you wear, and it lets you know what your sugar is doing. And sugar fluctuates. Your blood sugar fluctuates every 5 minutes, you know? So just kind of doing a static finger stick is not the whole picture. So you're definitely right. And these devices can go to your Apple Watch, your iPhone, your smartphone, and it gives you a trend so that you can have some behavioral modification, right? So if you see that you ate this meal and you spiked up to 200, it lets you know, I had too much starch in that meal. Next time, I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to go for a walk now so that my sugars can start to come down. And if it's persistently elevated, it gives you numbers in real time. So you're not waiting until you have that 3-month A1C with me or your primary care to say, okay, now my diabetes is uncontrolled. We really want to be ahead of it before we're doing that 3-month check. In terms of insulin pumps, so that's something for individuals who are on multi-dose injections. So they're on that Lantus or Humalog or Toujeo and Humalog. Whereas this is going to be insulin that's administered through a pump. So they don't have to do the sticks anymore. And it talks to the sensors. And then we always talk about now the new medications for the type 2s, which will help to lower sugars, but also help with weight loss, which is the main culprit. And those are the GLP-1s and GLP-GIP agents.
So are there any risks to taking these Ozempics, for example? I mean, it's the latest trend. Mm-hmm. You have to make sure that obviously if you're going to take these medications is under the supervision of a medical practitioner. Mm-hmm. You also want to make sure that you do the work. There's nothing easy in life. You want to make sure that you eat healthy. You want to make sure you monitor your calorie intake. You make sure that you get physical exercise. So you obviously want to start the dose, and then you go up to a certain level, and then if you want to get off, you have to taper the dose to get off. So it's not something you just want to go and... There are a lot of persons who are selling it unscrupulously online. There are a lot of persons who are... Because it's an expensive drug, mm-hmm. particularly if it's not covered by your insurance. Mm-hmm. So what do you advise someone who's interested in starting Ozempic, for example, and they don't happen to be a diabetic?
Okay. So as you alluded to, so if you have insurance and you're diabetic, it will be covered because these medications are now what we call first line for diabetic management. So if we look at American Diabetes Association, American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists guidelines for diabetes management, these medications are now at the top, right? So, you know, first we used to say metformin, glucovage, and then we add on. But these medications are kind of leading the pack because for one, it's getting to the main culprit and treating the main culprit of the diabetes is the diabetes syndrome. And also these medications are showing that there is a benefit to the heart. So they're reducing your risk of heart attack and stroke. It's helping to protect your kidneys from declining into diabetic kidney disease and end-stage renal disease. So there's lots of good benefits. And now they have been...
Reduces your risk of obstructive sleep apnea.
They do. Yes. It's actually now, it's one of the treatments for sleep apnea. So they have actually, tirzepatide or Mounjaro or Zepbound, which is the higher dosing for obesity only, Zepbound, actually has an FDA approval for treatment of sleep apnea. So these medications have, and we're even using it now for cardiac patients who are obese and not non-diabetic, also to reduce the risk of a further event. So these medications are great medications. Now, in diabetes, usually all these medications are marketed as lifelong, right? So if you really get the weight off, you have behavioral modification, sugars are really well controlled, and you really feel that you can maintain the weight, so you've made lifestyle changes, you may be able to taper it off, but these are meant to be lifelong, especially for the diabetics. For obese individuals who are interested in weight loss medications, I do think it's a great idea because a lot of people have this vicious cycle where they lose weight, gain weight, lose weight, gain weight. And that is not just lack of willpower. That is a physiological design in the body. The body always wants to defend its highest fat mass, right? This is why it's always better not to become fat. So the body wants to protect that. So as they lose weight, the body slows down the metabolism. It sends up hunger cues to make you feel hungry. You start to eat again and you gain weight. So what these meds do is they help to mitigate that kind of that response where you have this weight gain loss, weight gain loss, where you can help to maintain your weight loss, lose, and then also maintain the lower weight. So it is a game changer. So if you are obese and you're considering one of these medications, if you have a BMI over 30, so stage 1 obesity, you are a candidate for this. But it's meant to be added on to lifestyle changes, not just to be used in isolation. So you should be following a calorie-restricted diet, you should be moving, and you're adding these meds on to help you reach your weight loss targets, and then you're working on behavioral modification, meaning mindful eating, knowing your kind of stress cues, right? Getting enough sleep in, managing stress and anxiety, which may drive eating patterns, but it's used in the right way. And once you develop the skills to maintain the weight loss and make the lifestyle changes, I think in obese individuals, you can taper off and have good success in the long term.
Okay, we have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Pinto, and to the lady, the physician.
Dr. Davis Simmons.
All right. I am not familiar with her, but I just have some quick questions for some clarity. And I'd like for you to explain this in a detail more. And I mean, it could help the general public, right? But as you were talking about the intermittent fasting diet at the, I think it was in and out of the shop at the beginning of the show, right? As it relates to autophagy, right? I've been on surgeries and I've learned all about it. You know, you go this 16 hours, et cetera. They say in the study show that autophagy kicks in, right? Which will mean you will be deprived of food in some kind of way. And so I guess blood sugars should drop, and then autophagy kicks in, right, as it relates to cleaning up dead cells from apoptosis, et cetera, et cetera. And how important is that in preventing diabetes? And I'd like for you to also explain, I know they said excess weight is one of the factors in insulin resistance, right? So that would mean that let me know if I'm correct. The insulin would not be reaching into the cell. It will be building up, not the insulin, the glucose would be building up, and then the pancreas will keep producing insulin, and then and that means it's a detrimental effect. And so I'd like for you to explain it, because let me know if that's the chronology of events. I want to know if hyperinsulinemia actually translates to type 2 diabetes, and what role does visceral fat play in insulin resistance? Mm-hmm. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, great. So a lot of thoughts. So in terms of the intermittent fasting, so what we talked about is that that is a timed eating, right? So having a fed state and then having a fasting state. What I said is with that the intermittent fasting itself is not a diet. It's just timed eating. So if you are going to do intermittent fasting, it's important that you're getting in a healthy diet, especially if you're overweight or obese, where you're getting in still calorie deficit so that you can continue to have weight loss. So it should be done in an appropriate way. But yes, so intermittent fasting has generally a lot of benefits if done in the right way, where it can have lowering of the sugars in the morning. And there's multiple studies that show that. And this is classically in type 2s. The question about insulin resistance is one of the main culprits in metabolic syndrome and also in type 2 diabetes. So what is insulin? Insulin is a hormone that is made by the pancreas. Insulin is basically the key that opens the door to allow sugar into the cells to be used as fuel. All right. So sugar itself is not a bad thing. That's the main energy of your cells. All of your cells use that for fuel. The problem is when the sugar is sitting in the blood and it's not going where it's supposed to go. So when you have excess fat, that's one of the main culprits of insulin resistance in the kind of Western hemisphere because of obesity. So the excess fat produces what we call adipokines or chemokines that result in this kind of insulin resistance. So basically, if the sugar is sitting there, the insulin resistance is happening at the level of the muscle and the end target organs. So your body then pushes out more insulin to try to overcome that. So that's where the hyperinsulinization comes from. And with hyperinsulinization, that can have a lot of other downstream effects. It has a great tie to fatty liver, increasing glycogen stores in the liver. So that's one of the main causes of what we call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or metabolic liver disease.
Okay, we have another call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good afternoon, Pinto and your guest. Wonderful show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Pinto, I had left my number about a month ago with the producer, but you tried to reach me and I didn't respond. Let me just say quickly what I need to say.
Sure.
I have pain in a particular area from December every day and every night. And I to the point now I don't know what to do. I really need to see you.
Well, I'm readily available, and I'm glad to help you. It's hard to diagnose you or manage you over the phone, and obviously this is not a very discreet way to question you. So please, I'm in office tomorrow. I have two offices. I'm in both of them tomorrow. Even without an appointment, I'll fit you in. But please stop. Please stop suffering from December to now. I'll be at Family Medicine Center, Blake Road, tomorrow morning, and I'll be at Oak Tree main office in Palmdale tomorrow afternoon.
Okay, Blake Road, that's where? Doctor's Hospital?
It's diagonal across the street from Doctor's Hospital, Family Medicine Center.
Family Medicine?
Yeah, it's called Family Medicine Center.
What time can I come?
Anytime between 9 and 12.
Yes, I'll be there.
All right, take care. All right, so when we talk about diabetes, it affects every bodily system. How often should a diabetic actually see their physician or their internist or their endocrinologist? 3 times a year, 4 times a year? Obviously, it depends on the degree of control. And exactly. How often do you need to get an HbA1c?
So the A1c, yes, exactly. So it really depends on your level of control. So very well-controlled diabetics who have good knowledge, A1cs are well-controlled, good lifestyle management, I may see them every 6 months. That's few and far between. That's not the majority of people. So the majority of patients should be having an A1C. It's a 3-month test. So every 3 to 4 months to assess their diabetes control. And then on a day-to-day basis, they should be checking their sugars, see what their sugars are, what's happening in the real time. And that should be done fasting and a 2-hour post-meal check.
And they shouldn't be that fair. I mean, a lot of persons believe that no news is good news, and living in ignorance and believing. And a lot of persons, they might have been diagnosed with diabetes 10 years ago. They never saw a physician since. They're still on the same medication, the same dose. Certain persons, you're going to have to change the medication as they get older. You're going to have to change the dose. So a lot of persons think that once you're on a certain medication, whether it's for hypertension or diabetes or high cholesterol, you're on the same medication, the same dose for the rest of your life, and you don't need to have it adjusted at all. And that's completely incorrect. And it's alarming, and I'm sure you find the same thing. Persons don't know the name of the medication they're taking, much less the dose, and they've been taking it for year after year after year. I've taken a white pill, I'm taking a green pill, I'm taking a brown pill. Do you know what these pills do? No, I'm not really sure. You need to take some vested interest in your own health. You need to know what medications you're on. Let's say you're in a car accident, you need to give a proper history. Your family needs to know what your medications you're on as well. Even if it needs you carry around a list of medications or take a photo of it and have it on your phone so it's readily available, because certain other medications that you may need to get in an emergency situation can counteract with the medications that you're on. And you should be well aware of what the medications are doing and what potential side effects are for these medications. You don't just blindly taking medication given to you. You need to ask questions. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're given any medication, a physician will gladly answer any questions you have in terms of what are the possible side effects, what may you expect or not expect, how long do you need to be on these medications. So even as urologists, I'll prescribe medication for an enlarged prostate, and I'll speak to them endlessly about why you're on the medication, what the medication does. As the prostate gets older, as you get age, medication may become less and less effective. But a lot of men will take the medication, see their symptoms are improved, stop it, and then you'll see them 6 months later. What happened, doc? I took the medication for 2 months. I felt great, and I stopped it. I explained a million times, you got to continue to take it. So it's important that you have a good dialogue with your physician, that you have a good rapport, that you have a good understanding. They understand you. Not everybody clicks. If you don't get along with that physician, I'll be the first one to say, go and see somebody else. It's not going to hurt my feelings. Mm-hmm. I want my patients to have the healthiest version of themselves. I want them to have longevity. I want them to have good quality years on earth. Not every personality is going to mesh. Some people get along better with a female physician. Some people get along with the male physician. Maybe someone might have a certain thing in common or background in common that they may emphasize with certain individuals. So find that one physician that anything that's happening in my life, whether it's psychologically, emotionally, physically, you can reach out to them. You know that you're going to get confidential advice. No one's going to pass any judgment on you. You need to have that individual in your life. That's as important as picking a spouse. I would say next is picking a physician that you can trust and can get you through life and have the healthiest version of you. And you need to get your annual physical.
Prevention is better than cure. And as you allude to, self-care is a big part of diabetes management. So again, checking, taking your medications appropriately, making sure you're going for the appropriate screening, healthcare checks, which includes the A1C every 3 months. You should be getting your eyes checked annually, looking at your feet every day, having your
particularly as a diabetic.
As a diabetic, yeah. You should be examining your feet every day. If you can't see the bottom of your feet, get a mirror, take a look at it, examine it every day. But again, this is what we talk about, prevention, before this ulcer develops, sore, and then it leads to amputation from a non-healing ulcer. So it's important to self-care. So eye checks, foot checks, getting your routine screening done.
And we talk about, obviously, calorie intake. We talk about what we eat. But we didn't talk about the all-important, what we drink. We have a country that drinks way too much in the way of alcohol. Alcohol is going to put on the weight. That's going to affect you in so many ways. Alcohol has been shown to be a risk factor for at least 6 recognized cancers, including breast cancer. Yeah. So drink sparingly, if not at all. That would be the ideal. Particularly if you're overweight. Yes. Particularly if you're a diabetic.
It's excess calories. And then what is sparingly, right? So you'll have patients come and say, well, you know, I only drink now
6
and then.
Beers a night.
Yeah. But really what we're saying is for women, 1 drink a day, that's no more than that. For men, no more than 2 drinks in a sitting.
And if you want to have motivation, as I said, for men, erectile dysfunction, we can prevent you from getting erectile dysfunction by being a healthier version of you, by avoiding obesity, by having diabetes picked up early or prevented from getting diabetes or hypertension or cardiovascular disease. But a lot of these things are silent. You're not going to have any symptoms until it's already caused some damage internally. So that's why it's important to get your annual physicals. It's important to get a cardiac monitoring with an ECG. It's important for you to get those all-important bloods, your HbA1c. You should know as a male over the age of 40, what is your PSA, your prostate-specific antigen? You want to make sure you know what your kidney function is. What is your thyroid function? What is your lipid cholesterol profile? All those things, you're not going to know by how you're feeling until it's too late. So obviously, high blood pressure is a silent killer, but diabetes can also be the silent killer. Cardiovascular disease can be the silent killer as well. And the first manifestation of it for men, in many cases, is erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And I see it all the time. I don't want to give you bad news, but if you're a diabetic, and accept it, because it can prevent you from getting 1,000 more things going wrong with you throughout. If you don't want to see a physician, don't ignore diabetes, because you're going to be seeing a physician, you're going to be seeing a hospital, you're going to be seeing an emergency room. It's going to be the beginning of the end for you. And I've seen so many persons that knew they were hypertensive, knew they were diabetic, and then only take it seriously when they have had that stroke. When you see them coming in, using the cane, dragging that left leg, slurred speech, then they realize that, you know what, I should have taken this seriously. And if you've gotten to that point, at least speak to the people in your family. Mm-hmm. Say that, you know what, I made that mistake. Don't follow down that road. Yeah. I didn't follow up with prostate cancer screening. And I was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer. I didn't listen to everyone tell me I need to get an annual physical, and I ended up on dialysis. So don't listen to people who think only go see a physician when it's near death or you've been in a car accident or you have unbearable pain. You need to get those annual physicals to pick up things early. We need to be proactive. I speak all the time about certain things that we can do to prevent cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is killing far too many women, even in the prime of their life. We have a vaccine that essentially prevents cervical cancer. Why is it that people are dying and being diagnosed every other week with stage 3, stage 4 cervical cancer when free of cost, through the government clinics, you can get a HPV vaccine when you're a preteen or teenager, as a male and a female, I'll stress that, boys and girls, we can eradicate cervical cancer in our society by the next generation. No one needs to deal with prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is one of the easiest cancers to pick up, one of the easiest cancers to minimally invasively treat. No one needs to be dying of colon cancer. You need to get your colonoscopies, which is not only diagnostic, but therapeutic. We can pick up polyps, and which are pre-malignant, and prevent you from going down the road of getting cancer. So we don't take our health seriously. How do we, and I speak every week about, how do we talk some sense into people who wait until it's too late? And that's the vast majority of our society.
You're right. Prevention is better than cure. And it there's really no excuse, because now we have, you know, NHI, so there's access to primary cares. So it's just get your screening, and a lot of the screening is covered. So the A1C, the PSA, you can get that on your NHI labs. So there is really no excuse, but you have to make yourself a priority and get your health checks done.
And do it, if it's not for yourself, do it for your grandkids. Do it for your wife. You don't want to become a burden to them. Yeah. And if you see your husband not taking care of his health, you drag him.
Exactly.
You threaten him. You withhold whatever to get him to come in, even if it means you coming in with with your husband, or coming in with your uncle or your granddad. And I see it every single day. It's a grandkid. It's, I'll have to bring in 10 extra chairs because everybody in the family is there and they want to say, okay, this is happening to my granddad. That he doesn't want to say that's happening. We need to find a solution to it. We can't go on anymore. So if it means that you need to come in with your brother, if it means that you need to come in with your uncle and you don't want to come in alone, that's perfectly fine. Any physician will be happy to have a family member. But, but the take home message is you need to see a physician. You can't avoid
screening. Prevention.
That's and it has to start from young. Exactly. Even if you feel you're healthy, you have a normal body mass index, anything can be happening. You may be pre this, you might be pre that. Let's stop you going down that road and make a healthier nation. The health of the nation is the wealth of the nation.
Exactly.
And we are spending so much money on being reactionary and treating patients when they've gone to the nth degree in terms of metastatic disease of this cancer or that cancer or ending up on dialysis. Let's spend more emphasis, more economics, and more efforts into being preventative in preventative medicine. So it's a pleasure. The hour has gone very quickly. I'm very proud of you, Ariane. And at a personal note, we have so many cousins who are physicians. I think we can open up our own hospital.
But sure
can. Yes, so thank you to our grandfather who only went to grade 3 education, and he's had a generation and another generation of very educated persons, because although he never got the chance to be educated, he stressed education and the importance of education to his family. So please do the same for your family. Good night, and I'll see you again next week. Bahamas.
Good night.
Speak. Every urologist speak. Every urologist.